This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, powered by the Family Research Council, your embassy of faith, family, and freedom in the heart of our nation's capital. Now, here's your host, FRC President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this Tuesday edition of Washington Watch. Coming up, leading conservatives have a message for Republican leadership. Tax cuts alone will not engender the support needed to stave off a Democratic wave in November. Chris Wilson, CEO of WPA Intelligence, will be here to discuss what's needed to keep conservatives engaged. He'll also talk about the surge of early voting in Texas by Democratic voters. Following the deaths of four U.S. soldiers in Niger last October, key Capitol Hill lawmakers said they didn't even know the Pentagon had troops there. So, what's going on? Congressman Steve Russell of Oklahoma just returned from Niger, and he has some answers for us. Also, several Nigerian leaders are in Washington, D.C., meeting with Ambassador Sam Brownback, the new ambassador at large for international religious freedom. Now, Nigeria continues to endure challenges to growth as minority groups face religious persecution and horrific acts of violence that has destroyed the land and lives. One of those leaders is Polycarp Gbaja, and he joins us a little bit later here on Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T. Perkins. Check it out. Lots of resources there at the website for you. All right. There is no doubt that President Trump's tax cut bill was a big win for taxpayers and for the GOP. But conservative leaders say the GOP can't survive. They can't live on bread alone, or tax cuts in this case. The warning from conservatives comes as a new CNN poll found that 54% of registered voters say they would back a Democrat in their congressional district this year, while 38% said they would support a Republican. So what do conservatives have to do to keep their supporters engaged? Well, joining us now with the answer, Chris Wilson, CEO of WPA Intelligence. Chris, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, you bet, Tony. Thanks for having me on again.
So what are we seeing here? Are Republican voters complacent based upon last year's election? We've seen some special elections where the Democrat voters have outpolled the Republicans. So what's happening?
Well, we have. If you look at the last several elections, I'll just talk about on the federal level. There have been 15 special elections in which Democrats have outperformed their regular vote by an average of 17 points. And from that, it points to what I would call a turnout issue on our side with Republicans, with conservatives. And I would suggest that it's synonymous with a base issue on our side. And what I mean by that is, Tony, we're not motivating the Republican base. The Republican base is a group that turned out and gave Republicans majorities in the House in 2010 and the Senate in 2014, and they gave us the presidency in 2016. And while there have been some victories along the way, Neil Gorsuch, tax cuts, it's not been enough. And what we see is, due to a failure to accomplish things like repealing Obamacare, due to a failure to pass more restrictions on abortion, to move toward changing laws back to recognize marriages between a man and a woman, we have a base that is just not excited about Republicans right now. Their attitude is that we gave you full control of government and you're not doing anything with it. And whereas, as you suggest, tax cuts are a step in the right direction. I don't mean to downplay that at all. Neil Gorsuch was a step in the right direction. But without some real wins on the social conservative side, we are going to continue to see these types of Democrat victories. And fiscal issues are not enough. They're important. But without being able to have serious concrete accomplishments on the social side, I think you're going to see real problems for Republicans in 2018.
So, Chris, how did Donald Trump, as a candidate going into the 2016 election, where you had, as you pointed out, 2010, the Republicans took control of the House, 2014, they took control of the Senate, still did not deliver. But somehow the president was able to step over that, connect with the Republican conservative base, unlike any other candidate in recent times, and drive turnout to record levels. How did he do that?
Well, that's a great question. And the way that he did it was by talking about conservative issues. And a lot of it has to do with organizations out there. I mean, Tony, I give you and I give the Family Research Council a lot of credit for sticking by Donald Trump in the election in times where others did not. And because of, I think, the halo effect that endorsements from people like you carried and organizations like, and there were several of them. The National Rifle Association had a strong impact. There were, you could really walk right down the line and looking at a multitude of conservative organizations that got behind Donald Trump. And what it did, it had an impact. And I'll just give you an example. In 2012, Mitt Romney got 78% of the evangelical vote. Barack Obama got 21%. In 2016, Donald Trump got 80% of the evangelical vote. So it was a similar number. It was Romney won by 57 points, Trump won by 64 points. But the major difference is that in 2016, evangelicals made up 26% of the vote. And to illustrate those numbers numerically, those percentages, in 2012, there were 29,680,000 and change evangelical voters. So let's just say right under 30 million. In 2016, Tony, there was almost 35 million evangelicals, 34,906,000. So it was a difference of almost 5 million votes. And that was the difference on a state-by-state basis between Donald Trump winning and Mitt Romney losing. And if those evangelicals that turned out in 2016 and gave the presidency to Donald Trump do not turn out for Republicans in 2018, and they haven't been so far in a lot of special elections. Now, some of that is self-inflicted wounds. I mean, you can look at Alabama and see a reason why evangelicals might not have voted for the Republican nominee there. But in some of these specials, we'll see what happens in Pennsylvania here in a couple weeks. If you have candidates that are not doing an effective job, not just appealing to evangelicals, but also turning them out and showing separation between who we are as Republicans and what Democrats are and what they stand for, then again you're going to see Republicans lose seats, and it's likely to happen anyway. That's what happens whenever you're a party in power, but it doesn't have to happen. And if we turn out these voters, the same ones that turned out in 2016, you won't see the kind of losses. And in fact, you could even see Republicans pick up seats in the Senate.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday afternoon. Chris Wilson of WPA Intelligence with me. So one of the things that Donald Trump did is, even though he didn't have a track record on it, which you could also say that many members of Congress, you know, as a whole, has not really amassed a strong record on a lot of these conservative issues, but he ran hard on those issues. And quite frankly, I think he's delivered on a lot of those issues. So is there the potential here that Donald Trump is really what saves the GOP Congress, by people realizing that his agenda, the conservative agenda that he was elected on, is in jeopardy if voters don't turn out in November?
Well, I absolutely believe that Donald Trump knows that. And I think it's why you see him taking action on and still fighting for action in a lot of fronts. And it is, I agree with you. I mean, I have been, as you know, Tony, quick to criticize Donald Trump when I disagree with him or feel like he is on the other side of, you know, one of my clients. But at the same time, I give credit where credit is due. And I think he delivered in Neil Gorsuch, he delivered on tax cuts. And I think he is working to deliver in other areas. I mean, I can tell you, I know meetings that took place today with members of the Senate in which he was advocating for conservative policy. So I do give him credit for that. And I think he recognizes, I mean, if there's one thing that Donald Trump is almost uniquely good at, it is recognizing issues that appeal to his base. And he understands his base probably better than just about any anybody I've ever seen in American politics. And so whether he is able to deliver on that and continue to keep those voters motivated going into 2018 is going to be really the difference between us, as I keep saying, winning and losing. I do think there are also, where he may be delivering on that, I also think there are challenges with some of the rhetoric he uses. And I do believe that that has, you have seen evangelicals, and you can point to Mona Sharon
right.
and her speech at CPAC as one example, who've come out against that. And that's probably an area where I think other conservative leaders, evangelical leaders, could be helpful there, because that is probably not something that comes as natural to him as the overall as the issues seem to. And if that's one, from an issue standpoint, you know, he's there. From a communication or rhetorical standpoint, there may be kind of some differences between what we saw in 18 and what we're seeing, or what we saw in 16 and what we're seeing right now in the special elections in 18.
Well, Chris, I want to go to before I go to Texas and what's happening. I know you've got your finger on the pulse there in Texas, early voting there for their March primary. I want to get your take on that. But first, what are some of the solid, concrete steps that the Congress, Republicans in Congress, need to take between now and the election to bolster their standing among conservative voters?
Well, oh gosh, there's a litany of issues that could be addressed that I think could have an impact. I do think if we fail to repeal Obamacare, and I know some would argue that, well, we repealed the individual mandate and that should be enough, and that's the beginning of the end for it. But I'm not sure that's enough. And I think more has to be done there. I think we have got to have some accomplishment on life, whether it's the Born Alive bill, the 20-week ban, or any of the other options that are being addressed right now. I think it is very important that we have an achievement there. I think it is. I think there are things that can still be done on traditional marriage that could be motivational to our base, to the evangelical base. So those are just three things off the top of my head. I bet you'd probably be far more qualified to answer that than I would, and could name off multiple others. But the key
well,
thing
I do
is
have a list in my
agenda.
Pocket. Well, let's before we run out of time, give me your take on Texas Democratic voters outpacing Republicans there in the Lone Star State in early voting.
They are, but I think the Democrats are making a lot about this, and it's being reported aggressively by the sort of the liberal mainstream media about it. And just to give you an example, Democrats are actually up from 2016, from a presidential year, by about 11%, and they're up almost 87% over 2014. Republicans are down from presidential year 2016, 28%, but still we are up over 2014. Now, the key fact of us being up from 2014 is there's really not a lot going on statewide in Texas. So I don't think there's a lack of motivation amongst Republicans in Texas. I do believe Democrats are aggressively motivated there. Now, having said that, it may have as much to do with the fact that they weren't all that excited about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, just didn't turn out in 2016 the way Republicans did when we had, you know, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio on the ballot. It was an aggressive fight.
So not necessarily a harbinger of things to come in November.
That's right. That's right. Not at all.
Okay.
We still have our own fate in our hands, Tony. No doubt about that.
All right. Chris Wilson, as always, great to talk with you. Thanks for stopping by.
You bet. My pleasure.
All right, folks. Just a reminder, Washington Watch, FRC, does not endorse or oppose candidates for office. All right. Hey, coming up, Congressman Steve Russell, just back from Niger, is here with the latest. Don't go away.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, that's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As senior director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Hear Mr. Arnakis discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
This is Washington Watch, and I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. Again, just a reminder, as Chris Wilson was talking about the last presidential election, FRC and Washington Watch does not endorse or oppose or support any candidate for public office. What he was making reference to is what I did in my in other capacities. Okay. Last October, four U.S. soldiers were killed by Islamic militants in the African nation of Niger. Many Capitol Hill lawmakers said they didn't even know the Pentagon had troops there, which raised a number of questions. With us now is Congressman Steve Russell, retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Army. He served several deployments overseas and is now back from Niger. He represents Oklahoma's 5th Congressional District, serves on the House Committee on Government Oversight and Reform, as well as the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, you were on a fact-finding mission. What did you find out?
Well, I think the key thing for most Americans to realize is that our great special forces and the Nigerian soldiers that were caught in this ambush on October 4th were not doing anything outside what their normal responsibilities would have been. In combat, unfortunately, the enemy gets a vote sometimes. And what's remarkable is that this small team of soldiers was able, after being degraded, after losing some of their members, after being wounded, were able, with their Nigerian partners, to survive, fight in a very disadvantageous situation. And they were not only able to prevail, but they were also able to account for all of their own wounded and killed within 24 to 48 hours. What we can't lose sight of is the important efforts that we've been doing in places like Niger and Chad and Cameroon and other places for decades. This is not a new thing. And for some, like the New York Times is trying now to purport and then divulging drafts and, you know, what should be classified information that the FBI is not ready to release yet. okay, they can have the mechanics correct of what the actual ambush was, but I think their conclusions are way off base.
So what were our troops doing there to begin with?
Well, Niger is an interesting country in that it's very, very poor, but yet they are very, very cooperative. They are in a fight for their own existence, and they have highly trained forces that have been doing a remarkable job fighting al-Qaeda elements of the Maghreb, AQM, and then also Boko Haram, which is, aligned itself with ISIS and al-Qaeda affiliates. In these ungoverned spaces where you have desert regions, you've got a lot of harboring where they're trying to, export their brand of terrorism. Niger has never been an exporter of trouble. In fact, they've only been the recipient of trouble, and they're doing a remarkable job in defending themselves. And people should say, well, why do we care about these countries? Well, when we've seen ungoverned spaces, what happens is it doesn't stop there. The terrorism will begin to fester, and it exports and it causes problems in the region. And the problem that you have is that you have stable countries in sub-Saharan Africa. They're fragile economies with fragile agriculture. And if you have these Islamic jihadists prevail, then you've got famine, you've got disease, and you've got disaster in a widespread scale. So we need to continue to work with them to allow them to be able to defend themselves. And I can't say enough about the good work that our military has been doing and should be able to continue to do in the future.
Now, how significant, Congressman, of a presence does Boko Haram have there?
Well, it is pretty significant. Now, the French have been doing a magnificent job and a lot of work in the region, in Mali and the Chad Lake Basin and others. We've been working very well in Cameroon and Chad and also Niger. The combined efforts, if we act and stay on this course, again, this is not new. We've been in these countries for decades. But if we hold the line, then as we see ISIS and al-Qaeda on the ropes, then they will have no place to run to because these will not be safe harbors. If we have, based upon some reporter's agenda, we pull the plug in these regions, then they will have safe harbor and they'll be able to run to these sub-Saharan regions. Our military is fully aware of what is developing and what is going on. And sometimes, unfortunately, our men and women in uniform can be caught in danger. But they were certainly doing their job and they did it heroically.
Well, I mean, these places, deep in the African continent, you're chasing them out of the Middle East, and they're retreating to many of these places. And
they are. Right, that is correct. And what you see, to your point, in the North African Rim, you've got Libya that's been a complete disaster. You've got Algeria that is doing better, and they're trying to combat a lot of this. You've got terrorist elements in Sudan and South Sudan, and it's just a bad region, and to ignore it and think that, well, if we don't get engaged, it will somehow improve. Well, we did that in Syria, and how did that work out? Not too well. We ended up having to go in anyway, and unfortunately, you had great human suffering on a monumental scale.
The final question for you before we run out of time, Congressman Russell. When you look at this president, commander-in-chief, changing, in many cases, the rules of engagement to make it easier for our men and women to do their mission, are you confident that we're going to be able to defeat Boko Haram, al-Qaeda, and others, and ISIS?
Well, it's the important question to ask, Tony, because right now, if public opinion were to swing away based upon predetermined, almost pre-written outcome articles that are using certainly some facts about what happened, but having a different solution, of saying, well, why are we even there? Maybe we should just pull out. If we do that, we are not going to have the problem solved. What we have to do is continue to partner with these nations, not fight their own battles for them. But look, the Nigerians, they fought side by side. They mixed their blood with ours. In fact, it would actually be the reverse. We mixed ours with theirs in defense of their own country. They are certainly towing the line and doing the right things. But because they are fragile, we need to assist them. They are all in, and they are not exporters of trouble. We don't need to allow again, terrorist elements to have refuge once we've squeezed them out of some other place.
All right, Congressman Russell, as always, great to talk with you.
You bet, Tony. Thank you for covering it.
All right. All right, folks, don't go away. We're back with more after this.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay. Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers. The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue. If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Thanks so much for joining us on this Tuesday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at TPerkins. All right. Each year, thousands of Nigerian Christians have been murdered due to radical Islamic violence. Now, Nigeria, just below Niger, there in the African continent. Attempting to curb the slaughter, several Nigerian leaders are in Washington, D.C., meeting at the State Department. Including that meeting, Ambassador Sam Brownback, the new ambassador-at-large for religious freedom. Joining us now is Polycarp Gbajaja. Well, Gbajaja, thank you.
Polycarp Gbajaja.
International speaker. And he is the pastor of the Strong House in Nigeria and a member of the Geneva Institute of Leadership and Public Policy, and perhaps the leading authority in Nigeria on the Boko Haram, which we were just talking about with Congressman Russell, and very knowledgeable about the persecution of Christians. Polycarp, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. What are you asking of the State Department and our leaders here in Washington?
Well, first of all, our nation is under very intense crisis where severe human rights violations are going on. And we have come here to seek both the empathy and the intervention of the State Department. Because of non-state actors in gruesome massacres and killings going on in the Nigerian Middle Belt. So we have come here to make clear and for the U.S. Department to understand that very very criminal happenings have been going on in Nigeria. Killings have been going on in the middle belt of Nigeria. And after over 6 years, there have been no arrests, with over 5,000 to 7,000 people dead. Not a single person has been arrested. And now the Fulani herdsmen, who have been more or less invading, decimating, and occupying communities in especially the middle belt of Nigeria, have gone largely uncontained in Nigeria. So we are here to seek the assistance, the intervention of the State Department or the United States government in the case of Nigeria, which is well known and well documented. That's why we are here.
So, Mr. Gabaija, is your government not doing anything to protect the Christians there in your country?
No, not really. When you have a situation where for 6 years killings have gone on and no one has been arrested, no one has been prosecuted, almost at genocidal level, in 1 year alone in the southern Kaduna of Kaduna State. In 2014, there were 15 massacres with 1,004 people dead. It didn't even make the news in CNN. And this has gone on unabated since 2014. Just recently, between the 21st of December and the 1st, there were 6 massacres in southern Kaduna alone. And then later on, that same day, you must have heard about the massacre of 73 persons in Benue State of Nigeria. No one has been arrested. No one has been prosecuted of the Fulani herdsmen, who seem to be ubiquitous and yet somehow like phantoms, have not yet. No one has arrested them. You know that this is very much of a concern to people, and people have been killed, have been displaced. You have over 160,000 displaced persons.
I think we lost Polycarp. Let's see if we can get him back to finish. Mr. Gabaija, are you there? I think we're going to try to get him back to finish that conversation, because this goes back a number of years. First off, Mr. Gabaija, are you there? Polycarp?
Yep, I'm here.
Sorry, we lost you there for a moment. We're almost up against a break, so I'm going to ask you to hold on over the break here, but I want to continue our conversation. Is Boko Haram, who are they targeting in these attacks? Is it primarily Christians? Are they the ones that are being really focused upon in these attacks?
First of all, you need to understand that there are two different invasions in Nigeria. From the northeast, you have Boko Haram, which largely is jihadist in its agenda. It's from its claims, it's killing people because of its own brand of jihad that it's carrying out against Nigerians, but largely the attacks have been on Christian communities of the Middle Belt, stretching from the south of Borno and right across to two other states, Yobe State and Adamawa State. Of course, there have been also Muslim communities that have been killed because Boko Haram feels that its own brand of Islam is the only valid one. But
Mr. Gabaija, I'm going to ask you to hold for just a second. We're up against that break. We're going to come back on the other side of break. If you hold on just a minute, we'll finish that conversation on the other side of this break. Folks, you're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Don't go away. Polycarp's going to stick around. I hope you will as well. We're back right after this.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, that's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
Tony Perkins, and this is Washington Watch, the website tonyperkins.com. All right, going to go to the phone lines here in just a bit, but first I want to continue my conversation with Polycarp Gabaija. He is a pastor in Nigeria, also a leading expert on the Boko Haram and the religious persecution of Christians. Polycarp, thank you for staying around. I know that really for most Americans, Nigeria and Boko Haram really came on our radar screen back about 4 years ago when they kidnapped almost 300 schoolgirls there in Nigeria. And that actually just happened again last week, where about 100 girls were kidnapped by what's suspected to be Boko Haram. Oh, I think we lost him again. We got a bad... bad connection. Anyway, here's what I want to talk about. I'm going to get him back on the line. We're going to finish this conversation. Then I want to continue our conversation from yesterday, going back to our first story about I think voter apathy might be a little too strong. Hold on. We got Polycarp back on. Mr. Gabaija, thank you for sticking around. I was just talking about before we lost you there. For most Americans, the Nigeria and Boko Haram really hit our radar screens back, I think, in 2014 when nearly 300 schoolgirls were kidnapped. But there was a repeat of something like that last week where 100 schoolgirls were kidnapped, which is believed to have been done by Boko Haram, again, is what they suspect. Is this something that's regularly occurring?
Well, you see, apart from the schoolgirls of Chibok that took place years back, this is another one in a town called Dapchi in Yobe State. a lot of abductions have continued to go on. Villages are attacked, and every time they attack, they also abduct people. So this has been going on continuously. Everywhere they go, they attack, they abduct. And this has been the practice of Boko Haram through the years. So what happened last week at Dapchi was very unfortunate. If you can say, they caught the army with its pants down, and these people were defenseless children in school. And while this went on, of course, the question is, why were children in school in the first place in the war zone? And why were they not adequately protected? Where was the army when Boko Haram struck? So, yeah, this has been the practice of Boko Haram everywhere they go. They attack, they invade, they decimate, they abduct.
So your call upon the State Department and specifically meeting with Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, is to bring pressure upon the Nigerian government to do more to protect the religious minorities there?
Exactly. When we come here to try to give an understanding of the scope of the crisis in Nigeria, to raise global concern and awareness concerning the crimes committed against Nigerians through the State Department, to raise assistance and humanitarian relief for the displaced people, and then to determine the best approach to get justice for the victims. What is here is a fundamental denial and abuse of the human rights of a very endangered people and the minorities of the Middle Belt of Nigeria. And this has gone on for 6 years. And without any arrest being made and without any impressive show through the body language that the government of the present regime of Nigeria is even willing to take on the herdsmen. Very disturbing development.
Any commitments from the State Department to provide assistance and help?
Well, not yet. We are here still having discussions, and we hope that we will be able to have an audience with Ambassador Brownback, and to be able to put this across and to be able to reach a point where we can receive the assistance and they can advise us. So we are still in process, but we hope that sooner than later this can be done, because we are really at the precipice and a threshold of a literal implosion in our country. Never before have we come this close. And we are at a very dangerous precipice in Nigeria right now, because people have just about had enough for so long and for too long. So we are hoping that we would be able to quickly reach a point where there could be a way forward and a move forward through the State Department, which we know the United States government can definitely put pressure and get things moving for us.
All right. Polycarp Kabaija, thank you so much for joining us, and we certainly will keep an eye on this situation.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for having me, too.
Absolutely. Folks, this is just a little history here, and I'm very optimistic that Sam Brownback will give his full attention to this and weigh in, because this is who he is. But you go back when Boko Haram kidnapped these schoolgirls we were talking about. The State Department was reluctant, even prior to that, to even label them a terrorist organization. It was New Jersey Congressman Chris Smith and former Virginia Congressman Frank Wolf, who has since retired, that kept pounding them to get the Obama administration to label this group, Boko Haram, as a terrorist organization, which obviously triggers certain things. So we saw what happened in Iraq and to some degree in Syria, where the targeting of Christians and other religious minorities took place, to the point that the United Nations called it genocide. And reluctantly John Kerry, then Secretary of State in the Obama administration, came along and said, okay, all right. It's only because Congress was actually about to act and force them, they came out and said, yeah, this is genocide. We don't want that to occur. Now, it does not mean we have to send military. A lot of these things can just be done by the fact that we address these issues and we put priority on them. And that's why this position of ambassador of large religious freedom is so important, because almost all of these poor African countries receive assistance, foreign aid from the United States. Not that I agree with it, but it's there. We might as well make it conditional upon them providing protection to religious minorities. This is why elections matter. You get people who put a priority on this. And that's why here at home, I mean, a couple of things we can do on this front is, number one, our churches really need to be praying for Christians around the world who are being persecuted and killed for their faith. I mean, it's happening everywhere. I mean, we've had Open Doors USA on here many times talking about the unprecedented rise in persecution of Christians. So we need to be praying, but two, we need to take action. And one of the things we can do, and it brings me to another news story, is that we can protect religious freedom here at home. Because if we're not willing to protect religious freedom here at home, then why would we protect it overseas? And why would they think we would protect it? If we're not vested enough in religious freedom to make sure that our people here at home have it, why would we waste our time and energy to ensure that people in faraway places have it? So it's basically a green light to terrorists and tyrants like Boko Haram to act at will. Interesting story out of Georgia. I'm sure you're watching the debate over the NRA after the school shooting, and you get these Fortune 500 companies that want to, you know, instead of doing business, they want to do politics. And so Delta Airlines, announced that it would stop offering discounted fares to National Rifle Association members. It's part of one of those, you join the National Rifle Association, you get a discount on, FedEx, discount on Delta Airlines. They do this all the time. All the kinds of groups do this. Well, they, wanting to be politically correct, Delta announced that they would stop offering these discounted fares. Well, go back to 2016. There was another debate. And by the way, Delta is headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia. And so the Georgia legislature, as a response to Delta's announcement on the National Rifle Association, the lieutenant governor there, Casey Cagle, who is also the head of the state Senate, said that they were going to strike down a $50 million sales tax exemption on jet fuel, which Delta would be the primary beneficiary if Delta wanted to play politics. Well, let me tell you what's led to this, is that it was 2 years ago, Delta weighed in on the issue of religious freedom in Georgia. You might recall there was a high-profile case there with the former Atlanta fire chief, Kelvin Cochran, and it led to the introduction of a Religious Freedom Restoration Act type of bill. And Delta was one of the lead companies to weigh in against it, and Governor Nathan Deal of Georgia was, glad to trade 30 pieces of silver for religious freedom. So they easily gave up the First Amendment. Well, I warned that big business, as they have been basically hijacked by the leftist in this country, that eventually they were going to keep marching. If they could do away with the First Amendment, the Second would come. And here's the irony. And I go back to my time in public office. there's long been an alliance between the GOP and big business because, generally speaking, conservatives are for lower taxes, less regulation, which is a mixture, a recipe for economic development. And I still support that. But sometimes big business wanting more. And so the very conservatives that they have benefited from being in office, they turn on these social policies, which puts these GOP lawmakers at odds with their constituents, as we were talking about earlier with Chris Wilson, who want to see action on not just the bread and butter issues, the economic issues, but they want to see it on the moral issues. They don't want our country bankrupt monetarily, nor do they want it bankrupt morally. And so now, finally, they're drawing a line and saying, no, we're not giving in on the Second Amendment. If Delta wants to play politics, let them play politics. My suggestion to business, to big business, is do business. All right? If you fly planes, fly them. Leave the politics to us or somebody else. I'm actually hoping we're entering a period where lawmakers are going to stand up to these big business bullies who want to threaten economic catastrophe every time conservatives want to protect constitutional freedoms. And I'm glad to see the lieutenant governor there, Cagle, in Georgia, get a backbone to stand up to Delta. They had a hard time. Governor Deal couldn't find a backbone to stand up on religious freedom. The lieutenant governor taking a defense on the Second Amendment. Big business, I hope their days are numbered from a standpoint of their cozy relationship with conservative lawmakers. That conservative lawmakers realize that big business is no longer their friend. And when it comes to whose side they're going to be on, I hope they'll be on the side of the Constitution and the people, not big business. So this is actually an encouraging development in the state of Georgia. Fly planes. Leave the politics to somebody else. All right. Well, after all, we didn't get a chance to go to the phones, but I wanted to. The religious freedom issue is so critical. I cannot underscore how important it is that we defend religious freedom both here and abroad. And again, the best way to keep our freedom is to use our freedom. So don't hesitate. Talk about it. Use it. Share your faith. Talk about your faith. Defend your faith. It's time that we begin pushing back on the left that wants to silence us and to take away those fundamental, vital freedoms that others look to America as a source of inspiration and yearn to have those freedoms. Folks, don't take those things for granted. All right. Let me encourage you, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're not already receiving my daily updates, issues like this that I talk about in greater detail in my daily update. All right, tomorrow we'll be broadcasting from Nashville as we head to Nashville, Tennessee for the National Religious Broadcasters. I'll be speaking there this week, so we'll be broadcasting from there. All right, until next time. I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians chapter 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. Again, that's 1-866-372-7234. 372-7234.